We are the Forsaken. Forsaken.
You're listening to a Corpse Run Radio minicast. Hello, darlings, and welcome to Corpse Run Radio minicast, episode 20.3. This episode, we have Grand Nagus with information on Teldrassil, Noble 87 with The Story of Moradin Bronzebeard, Part 2, Asmund Gold with Real Talk about the Warcraft movie, and this song by Charm with lyrics written by Rowan of Moonguard called Tainted Light. I hope you enjoy, and have a good week, darlings.
So pure, my demon snares let you go nowhere. You've lost the fight. You curse and vow I will see the light. Once I ran from you, now I'll run to you. This tainted light corrupts you. All your resistance I have burnt through. Take my darkness and tainted light, tainted light. Banishment will end when you relent. You don't need to repent. The light can no longer comfort you the way I can. You have someone who understands. You think love is the light. So right. Once I ran from you, now I'll run to you. This tainted light corrupts you. All your resistance I have burnt through. Take my darkness and my demons. Oh, tainted light, tainted light.
What's up, y'all? It's me, it's your boy Asmund Gold, and today I figured I'd make a short video and talk to you guys a little bit about the Warcraft movie. And I haven't really wanted to make a video about this or talk about it too much just because the movie's not out yet. I mean, the trailer's not even out yet, so anything we can really discern from what we know now is all just assumptions. Anyway, Legendary, who's one of the production companies that's involved in the Warcraft movie, categorized the Warcraft movie, and this is from a source, and so is this really true or not? We're going to assume it is. They categorized it as a problem movie, and I think this is kind of a valid concern with them, and Duncan Jones, who's the director of the Warcraft movie, responded back, and he said basically the same thing that I think anybody would obviously think, is that there have been a lot of computer games and video games that have been ported to movies haven't really done that well. I think there was a Hitman movie, there's a Blood Rain movie, I think should have been a porno, it would have been way better, and there have been a number of other ones that have just been absolute complete trash. There have also been some good ones. So I thought Doom was okay. I still have Final Fantasy Advent Children. The Super Mario movie was great, but I think that was because I was 7 and I saw it. And District 9, if you guys didn't know this, District 9 was supposed to actually be the Halo movie, and so a lot of the assets from District 9, you can see a very striking similarity to Halo, Halo things in Halo, and so... And District 9 was kind of okay, but of course this was a different plot and everything. And so there have been some good ones. There have been some good ones, but there have been a lot of bad ones. And so I think that obviously a lot of people are kind of concerned about this. Like, for me, that's kind of the way that I think about it. I think, like, one of the main problems that I can see with the story, the Warcraft movie story, and if you guys don't really know what it is, it's kind of like following the events, best of my knowledge, like the events of the First War. And so this is like King Lane, Lothar, Medivh, and this is like Medivh opening up the portal, and like Gul'dan, and so all kinds of like really kind of old school crazy shit. But the only problem that I can really like kind of see with this is that Lothar, King Lane, and I mean like even Gul'dan to an extent are not like really kind of the main flagship characters of the Warcraft franchise. I mean, obviously Illidan, the Lich King, and maybe Deathwing, and even to a lesser extent Garrosh would be probably the people that if somebody saw a picture of these guys, they would think World of Warcraft. And so, you know, especially because whenever the game was in, like, kind of its, like, real, like, major hype stages, like Wrath of the Lich King and Burning Crusade, you know, and even a little bit to Cataclysm, people at least knew who Deathwing was. You know, I think that a lot of people who are going to watch this movie might not really be able to be as attached to it as if it was a story about, like, Illidan or Arthas or something like that. And that's not to say, by the way, because Duncan Jones said that it might be a possibility that this could end up being a trilogy, and so we could see, like, the First War, the Second War, and the Third War, and maybe ending with, like, Arthas, taking up Frostmourne and killing people and killing his father. I think that that would be pretty badass, and so we don't really know what's going to happen there. But that could also be a good thing, the fact that the story, the First War story isn't really as fleshed out and understood by fans as the Third and even the Second War story, just because, you know, Warcraft 1 was a very long time ago, and unless you kind of read, like, kind of the extended lore of the game, you don't really know a whole lot about it. And what that can really allow them to do is kind of, do things that maybe, would be better for a story, but not necessarily in the same canon of the actual storyline that Blizzard has created. And so there are a lot of times that's happened, like in Lord of the Rings, for example, whenever Gandalf, this is like just a small thing, whenever Gandalf leaves and, he leaves Frodo the ring and he comes back, I think like 20 years has passed between like whenever he went over to Minas Tirith and he like did research and finding the one ring and is this one ring. And so like whenever he comes back and throws the ring in the fire, I think like 20 years had passed at that point. But we don't really ever know that, and so there are a lot of things that are kind of cut out of Lord of the Rings, Tom Bombadil, and a lot of other things as well that kind of just make it to be more coherent for a viewer, even though it might be a little bit more frustrating for somebody who's more, aware and knows the Tolkien universe better. And so we can see that maybe happening with the Warcraft movie as well. And I think that another way that you can see that is that the Warcraft, like the logo for the Warcraft movie is very different. It's not like World of Warcraft. It doesn't really have a lot of resemblance to the games. And so we can kind of see that there is a little bit of a breaking away from the actual game and trying to make their own thing with the movie. And I think that will be easier for them to do that because they don't have kind of that, that fan base that's expecting things to go exactly a very, very specific certain way with, like, you know, the Arthas story or the Illidan story or Garrosh or maybe even Deathwing. And so that's something that I can see would be positive and negative. One thing that I think a lot of people have criticized, and like I think that a lot of you guys have probably seen the because like there's like some footage, like somebody recorded it at Comic-Con, and like there's some guy, and people have criticized it as being like overly CGI. Some guy said it's just one big computer. Like, I don't know. Is like, do you think they're going to hire real orcs? You know, of course it's one big computer. Like, the orcs aren't real. You have to, that's what you have to do, right? And so I thought that was kind of funny, and I wanted to mention that because, I mean, there have been a lot of movies, and a lot of movies that you guys don't even know that were actually very heavily CGI related. I remember Beowulf was kind of like one of the first movies that had, and this is, I think, in 2006, that had like one of the biggest transitions from like kind of, that there was both, character acting and also the, the CGI involved at the same time. And that movie I thought was pretty good. And so there have been a lot of movies since then that have had a lot of CGI built into them that a lot of people don't even really know about. Game of Thrones has that a lot. And so I don't really consider that a bad thing or a good thing. It really kind of just depends. I mean, the cinematics for Warcraft, are amazing. Like, the War of Draenor cinematic was awesome. And so, they didn't have any real orcs in that one either. And so we can see how that's going to go. And I think that really, what this really comes down to, the Warcraft movie, is how well really the actors do and how well everything really comes together. I think that's really kind of the same with any movie. But I'm probably not going to see it like the first day or something like that. I'm very curious to see how it's going to go. I think Travis Fimmel is in the movie. He plays Rhaegar on the Vikings and the show. And so he's a good actor. There have been a number of other good actors in the movie. I think one of the guys who's playing, I think, Orgrim Doomhammer, actually plays World of Warcraft and is in like a raiding guild and everything. And so that's always really cool to have people that have a vested interest and like kind of a previous understanding and a attachment to the source material that you really do it. It's the same with, Christopher Lee actually knew Tolkien and used to read the books every year, the Lord of the Rings books. And so obviously, that kind of stuff really kind of makes the movies better, and it kind of gives it, more depth and enjoyment. And I think not only that the actors are enjoying doing it, but the audience is enjoying seeing, I think it would just kind of like create better performance. So I'm not really sure how the Warcraft movie is going to go, and I don't think really anybody is. But I don't really think that it's out of line to consider the Warcraft movie definitely a potential problem because of how bad the previous video game to movie ports have gone. But you never know, because there have been a couple of ones that have turned out pretty well. So anyway, guys, I just wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about this because I haven't really talked about it at all. We'll see how it goes, and I guess like maybe next time they come out with new information, I'll talk about that too, but we'll see. Anyway, that's pretty much all I got. So thanks for watching, and like, comment, subscribe.
Hello and welcome. Today I'm going to talk about Teldrassil. Teldrassil is one of the more unique zones in the game, since literally the entire zone is the world tree by the same name, and the capital of the Night Elves, Darnassus, is located on top of it, together with most of the other parts of the zone. Now let me start off with the flight points, because they are kind of special too. Once we leave the starting area, that is called Shadow Glen, and we get out into the general zone of Teldrassil, we encounter the first flight point in the first small town of Dolinar. Then we have Darnassus, the capital, and the flight point there. And that flight point is next to a portal that takes you directly to the roots of the world tree and the village that's located there with the docks, and another flight point, and that's called Ruthoran Village. If you want to fly up, you can do so as well. Fly up the tree. That's going to take a couple of minutes, so that's how big the tree is. It's a world tree, so if you know how big Nordrassil is in Mount Hyjal, and you never took the time or thought about it, it's about as big as Teldrassil is. So just to give you a perspective there. In Ruthoran Village, we have two docks for boats to take you to two different destinations. The western dock takes you to Azure Mist Isle, the starting zone for the Draenei and the Exodar that's on that island, the capital of the Draenei. But now back to Teldrassil. Geographically, there isn't much to be told about the zone or the tree. We have a couple of different beasts living there beside the Night Elves. We have some Firbolgs, we have some Harpies, we have some Satyrs, so nothing too fancy there. If we go into the lore of the tree itself, that's quite a different story. because Teldrassil is basically something that shouldn't have been, because when Nordrassil got destroyed, it got destroyed basically after the defeat of Archimond, the Night Elves didn't have a home anymore. Teldrassil was created after the invasion of the Burning Legion, and when Malfurion Stormrage went missing and his presence was missing, Archduid Fenrir Stackhelm took over the leadership. If you remember back to Vanilla WoW, that's who was head of the Night Elves, more or less. If you don't really count, and you couldn't really count Tyrande Whisperwind, because she was the priestess, high priestess of Alun, and back then you had to go for one of the daily quests that you could do in Darnassus. You had to go and get some bags of morrow grain seeds. And then you had to go to Ongoro Crater in the south of the continent to get some Ongoro earth. And then in this item, in this pouch you had in your inventory, you could combine a seedling and a batch or two of earth, and that would give you a item that you could open, and you had a chance to get some morrow grain out of it. And you could repeat that, I think, every 15 minutes. And you could thereby, by turning in this morrow grain to Fenrir Stackhelm, you could gain rep from that. If you read the book that is called Stormrage, you will get a little insight, or quite a bit of insight, into what Archduid Fenrir Stackhelm did with this morrow grain that we collected for him. See, he used that to manipulate the world tree, to corrupt it, and to keep the Emerald Nightmare going, so to speak. Because eventually Malfurion was captured inside the Emerald Nightmare and was, you could call it, tortured to some extent. And then by using this morrow grain on the tree, Fenrir kept that outside evil going and sustained it, which was all leading into the Emerald Nightmare. I don't want to spoil too much of the book. You should really go and read this book if you want to know more about it. It's not the best book of the World of Warcraft books, but if you want to know about the lore, Stormrage is the book that you want to read up on when it concerns the Emerald Dream, the Emerald Nightmare, and all the druidic things that have been going on. Especially since we get the raid called the Emerald Nightmare in Legion. So again, if you want to know the basis of why the raid is what it is and have a little more insight, go read Stormrage. The book is written by Richard A. Knack, so maybe that's one aspect of why people think it's one of the lesser books. It's also available as an audiobook if you prefer that, so that's another option that you have. There's not really much else to say about the Zone of Teldrassil, so I'll keep this segment short for this week, in light of the fact that next week it's going to be a full episode, episode 21, and that's going to be long enough. If you have questions or suggestions for me, if you have suggestions regarding what zone you want to hear covered, you can tweet me at grandnegus1, you can write me an email, towerofcommerce@gmail.com, or you can write into the show, corpserunradio@gmail.com. This has been Grand Negus, Rule of Acquisition, number 19, Satisfaction is not guaranteed. Bye guys!
Hello everyone! Last week, we did the first part of Murderdin's storyline, in which we talked about his time with the Alliance of Lordaeron, training Arthas, all the way to the moment where Arthas picked up Frostmourne, claiming that he would pay any price, and that price turned out to be his longtime friend, Murderdin. Arthas tried to heal Murderdin, but the whispers of Frostmourne convinced him to leave the dwarf behind that he was on the right path. He got his revenge by striking down Mal'Ganis, and he followed his journey of summoning the Legion and merging with Ner'zhul. Now known as the Lich King, Arthas sits upon his frozen throne in Northrend, but Murderdin's story isn't quite done yet. Ladies and gentlemen, let's find out what exactly happened to Murderdin. I hope you'll enjoy. It seemed like Murderdin's life was the great price Arthas had to pay to claim Frostmourne, but the dwarf actually survived the events in the cave, and he woke up with the biggest headache ever, no memory of who he was or where he was. This is explained as we quest during Wrath of the Lich King, where we're sent on a mission to find and help Bran Bronzebeard with getting his hands on Norgannon's Keystone and access to the archives within Ulduar. During the questline, we're asked to gain King Yorick Stormheart's aid, but King Yorick Stormheart, he does not trust us immediately. First, we have to prove ourselves in battle, and as we travel to our challenge, Valok Icebellow explains how Stormheart became their king. Years back, my father and several other Frostborn were returning from a trek across Dragonblight. There was a heavy blizzard, far worse than we've ever seen since. They crossed a trail of blood-soaked snow, followed it to a dwarf wandering, and speaking in a dialect they couldn't make out. And not a dwarf of our kind, mind you, but a mountain dwarf. Something our kind had not seen before. The dwarf seemed lost, having no memory of where he came from, or even his own name. Not being the kind to leave a dwarven cousin to die in the snow, my father's party, they took him in, and they continued back towards Frosthold. Not long later, out of nowhere, the snow burst before them, and a Jormungr the size of Varanus herself came down upon their party. One of them was swallowed whole before they had even time to react. My father thought that they were all doomed, but behind him, a furious roar rumbled across the snow, and he turned to see the mountain dwarf growing in size, his skin taking on stone-like texture, and his hand sizzling with lightning. The dwarf battled forward with a sound like rolling thunder and hurled a shining metal hammer, lightning coursing over its surface directly into the Jormungr's throat. The Jormungr collapsed instantly, its head barely still attached to its convulsing body. My father turned to the dwarf in awe and raised a fist in praise. This stranger, having no name of his own, my father deemed Yorick, a name reserved for the champions of legends. Years later, he now stands before us as Yorick Stormheart, King of the Frostborn. As we follow the questline, as we gain King Stormheart's trust and we find what Bran was looking for, he decides it's time to meet the king himself and thank him in person. To Bran's shock and surprise, King Stormheart is actually his brother Murderdin, long believed to be dead. Memories start flooding back to Murderdin as even his oldest brother Magni shows up. Magni was informed that Murderdin is Northrend by a seer, so he shows up. Murderdin tries to remember his life before he joined the Frostborn, and all he remembers are nightmares. Nightmares of a human, tall, light hair, death black armor, Arthas. Murderdin feels responsible for letting Arthas slip to the dark side like that without really doing anything about it. Regrets won't change a thing though, only actions can make things right, so Murderdin decides to join the Arson's Crusade as they assault Icecrown, while Bran goes to party in Ulduar and Magni returns home. In Icecrown, they find out that Bolvar Fordragon, a hero of the Alliance that supposedly died at the Wrath Gate, he's actually still alive. The Lich King has been working on torturing his soul, trying to force Bolvar to serve, but Bolvar will never serve.
Never! I will never serve you!
Could it be, Lord Fordring? If Bolvar lives, mayhap there is hope for peace between the Alliance and the Horde. We must reach the top of this cursed place and free the Paladin!
By the light, it must be so.
Prepare the Skybreaker for an aerial assault on the Citadel!
With the ship called Skybreaker, Murderdin and his troops quickly go out to secure a forward base in Icecrown, but in the air, they encounter the Horde, who have a very similar plan. A fierce sky battle follows, with a different winner depending on which faction you play. If you play for the Horde, you'll win as the Horde. If you play for the Alliance, you'll win for the Alliance. But for the sake of the video, I'll assume that Murderdin and the Alliance won.
Don't say I didn't warn you, scoundrels! Onward, brothers and sisters!
Their next encounter is with another victim of the Wrath Gate, Saufeng's son Drenosh, now turned into a Death Knight.
A lone orc?
against the might of the Alliance? Charge!
Dwarves.
With Muradin being choked in the air, heroes take down the servant of the Lich King, and as they do, his father shows up to reclaim the body of his fallen son.
Don't force me hand, Orc. We can't let you pass. Behind you lies the body of my only son. Nothing will keep me from him.
I can't do it. Get back on your ship and we'll spare your life.
Stand down, Muradin. Let a grieving father pass.
Varian tells Muradin to stand down, and in a great display of respect, they let Cao Feng pick up his son and carry him home. Muradin goes on to secure the deck, prepare soldiers for an assault on the Upper Citadel, while heroes of the Alliance and Horde, they continue the journey through Icecrown Citadel, they continue the assault, and eventually they bring down the Lich King. Muradin wasn't present in that final confrontation when justice was finally delivered, yet players did defeat the Lich King while holding Shadowmourne. They have the option to loot Arvs' training sword and return it to Muradin.
Oh, lad. How I miss those endless days in Lordaeron. Sharpening your skill with this dull blade. Forging you into a weapon meant to withstand the demands of a great destiny. You sure put them skills to use, didn't you, lad? If only I'd been able to stop you that day. How different things might have been. If only I'd have never discovered that accursed blade. Farewell, Arthas. My brother.
After the events in Northrend, Muradin's role would shift back from being a fighter to being a politician. Around the time of the Cataclysm, King Magni Bronzebeard, he tried to use an ancient Titan ritual to communicate with the land. This ritual was supposed to give them insight as to what was going on with the world. There were signs of the Cataclysm, they weren't sure what was happening, but instead of communicating with the lands, Magni, literally, he became one with the lands. As Prince Anduin and several other people watched, crystals engulfed Magni's body. It was clear that Magni was no longer capable of ruling his people, and with grief in their hearts, griffins were sent out to find either Muradin or Bran, but Magni's daughter Moira had other plans in mind. Moira, daughter to Magni, she was kidnapped by the Dark Iron Dwarves, but the ruler, Emperor Fauruzan, he showed Moira the respect that her father never gave her, simply because she was born as a female. Even though Magni always believed that Fauruzan used some sort of spell to keep Moira under control, in truth, she really fell in love with the Emperor, and she gave Fauruzan a son. Adventurers were sent to bring the king's daughter back. They killed her husband, father to her child, and Moira was pissed. With the crystallization of her father, Moira decided that it was time for her to return to her city to reclaim her rightful place as ruler of Ironforge. Together with the Dark Iron Dwarf, she held the city hostage, including Prince Anduin. The Deep Rontrem was closed down, the griffins were locked away, and news of this reached Varian Wrynn. You don't mess around with Varian's family, so together with the members of the SI7, they infiltrated Ironforge, they lifted Moira out of her bed, and Varian was about to bring sweet justice, but his son prevented that. Anduin explained that although Moira's actions were wrong, she was the legitimate heir to the throne. Killing her would just send the city into civil war, possibly dragging the other factions within the Alliance with them, so killing Moira was not the way to go. Varian, with a knife placed against Moira's throat, he saw wisdom in Anduin's words, and he decided that Moira would get a second chance to prove that she was worthy to lead her people. Like him, she had to become better, and she couldn't be trusted to rule alone. So instead, a council was formed. A council where all three clans, Dark Iron, Wildhammer, and Bronzebeard, each of them had their own leader representing them. For the Dark Iron Dwarves, it was obviously Moira who spoke for them. The Bronzebeard clan was represented by Muradin, while the Wildhammer Dwarves at first were represented by Curdren Wildhammer. The world had not seen a union like this. The clans living together with Ironforge in over 200 years, and coming together like that did not come without complications. The clans, they did not trust each other. They came from different backgrounds, one like the air, one like the earth, one like the shadows. It was a big mess, and bringing these clans together was a very difficult job. Now, to bring their people closer together, Moira suggested that they should reforge the Hammer of the High King, also known as Modimus's Hammer. An ancient scroll had showed up describing how the hammer had been split up into 3 different pieces after the king passed away, and each clan had one of the pieces of the fragments. Moira and Muradin, they were on board with this plan. They thought it was a good idea, a good symbolic way of reforging the old alliances. But Curdron, he was not willing to give up his piece of the artifacts. During his time in Outland, as they were fighting demons and orcs, this piece of home gave them hope, reminded them of who they were, and he did not want to give it up. Discussions and debates followed not only amongst the council, also amongst their people, up to the point where the dwarves, they simply started to attack each other. After one Bronzebeard dwarf and one Wildhammer dwarf killed each other in a brawl, Curdron realized that for the sake of his people, he had to give up his artifacts. He felt like he had no choice, so he placed it down and he agreed to their plan. Now, throughout the story, they find out that the scroll is actually fake and that their plans are built on lies. But by this point, it doesn't matter. The people of the city, after so many discussions, after so many debates, they believe that this is the truth, that the artifact is real. And to back away from it now would just cause more trouble than to go through with it. Curdron at this point is just frustrated with the whole situation, with the politics, with the lies, with being trapped in Ironforge. He decides to sit down at the Wildhammer Roost as he thinks about the situation. A small brawl between the Dark Iron Dwarves and members of the Wildhammer clan, Curdron's clan, was about to erupt. One of the Dark Irons, they tripped over a stray pile of draw straw, sending the keg of beer that he was carrying flying over, spilling on the floor. Like I said, the clans, they had a very hard time adjusting to their new life. And Curdron, he was planning to defuse the situation. He tried to talk them down to stop this fight from even happening, but the Dark Iron Dwarf spat in his face, and before he knew it, his fist connected with the Dark Iron's head.
A fight! Count me in! Everyone! Get in here!
In the brawl that followed, a nearby brazier was knocked over. The embers erupted to spilled alcohol, sending the entire roost ablaze. Water was quickly called for, as they did their best to save their griffins, but Curdron's longtime friend Skyri, she refused to leave her axe behind. Even with her fellow griffins trying to pick her up, carry her out of the flames, she broke herself loose and she tried to protect her children. Tried as she might, it was no use. Her axe were boiled, her body was black as smoking, Curdron was dizzy, and he decided that it was a mistake to have ever come to Ironforge. The city had stripped him of nearly everything he once was, nearly everything that he once knew, but the city had not taken his one piece of the artifacts. He went to steal it back, and as he did, as he got it from the chest that they stored it in, he was caught in the act by Moira. A calculated smile was on her face as Curdron figured out that it was Moira who had forged the documents, manipulated events, kept the rumors within Ironforge going. Curdron even went as far as to blame her for the fire that took his friend's life, but Moira told him that she had nothing to do with it. As the story was told to her as the events were recounted, it was Curdron who threw the first blow. All Moira wanted was Curdron and the Wildhammers out. They had never been willing to extend a hand of peace to the Dark Iron Dwarves. Their opinion was already fixed when they arrived. It was clouded by old hatreds that they were clinging to, and Moira wanted Curdron gone. Sweat began pouring down his body. Every breath seemed filled with stagnant heat, not air. Curdron shoved the scepter through an opening in his chest piece near his arm. With the heirloom hidden, he rushed out of the room and towards the gates of Ironforge as the city stone walls closed in. Curdron inhaled the frigid air at Ironforge gates deeply. The sweat covering his body chilled in the cold night, and he shivered. In the distance, through a curtain of snowfall, shapes illuminated by light from the open city gates, they were unloading crates from a cart. One of the silhouettes looked up at Curdron's direction. It trudged through the snow toward him. It was Muradin.
Been looking for you, lad. I cannot say how sorry I was to hear about Skyri. She died like she lived, free of fear, fighting for what was most important, her people. And her future.
Her future died with her.
Muradin stood for a moment, silent.
Aye, but I'd rather die for me kin in a fight I know I can win, and not fight at all. I suppose you wouldn't understand much about that there, would you?
Curdon's eyes narrowed at the affront, but he felt weak after the encounter with Moira.
I've been fighting for me kin since the day I set foot in Ironforge.
Don't you mistake stubbornness for bravery. They ain't the same.
Yeah, wouldn't they understand? You're no different than Moira.
Myrddin sighed and lowered his head.
When you joined the council, I thought to myself, now there's a dwarf who can set the bickering in this city straight. Instead, all you did was make things worse.
Aye, because I had to go at it alone. You greeted me with open arms, but as soon as I made a stand for something I believed in, you turned your back on me.
How many times did I tell you that this business with the hammer wasn't worth fighting over? Stop wasting my breath when it was clear you wouldn't listen to reason.
To the Bronzebeard's credits, Curdon recalled numerous times in the past where Myrddin had approached him in private and spoke with him about giving up the Wildhammer Scepter. But each of those conversations had seemed more like a personal attack than advice.
Don't you see, lad? That old piece of iron is a shackle holding you back. Holding this whole city back. The more you argue about it, the tighter it becomes.
And what if I didn't go through with the reforging tomorrow?
Curdon blurted out. As the words left his mouth, he felt the scepter hidden beneath his armor dig into his ribs. Myrddin's brow furrowed. He looked at Curdon with disdain.
Magni enjoyed the tales of your fighting with Skyri in Outland. I'm only happy that he isn't here to see the fool you really are.
Curdon had considered telling Myrddin about his confrontation with Moira. Now, though, he wondered if Myrddin had colluded with Magni's daughter. Yet there was an air of forthrightness to Myrddin that lessened Curdon's fears. In a way that made the Bronzebeard's words all the more painful to hear.
That scepter kept the heart of my clan alive in Outland.
The heart of your clan is in ye. It was in Skyri. And he's seen all those Wildhammers in the city suffering every moment that you keep arguing. I'm trying to move this city forward, not bring it down with nonsense about old iron.
Move forward? The hammer wasn't the right way to move forward when we thought it was real. And it sure isn't the right way now that we know it's a lie.
Myrddin took a deep breath and placed his hand on Curdon's shoulder.
Just let it go, lad. Nothing good comes without sacrifice. You know that more than any of us.
Is that the reason you were looking for me? To tell me how to run my clan?
Myrddin's face became twisted in anger. He glanced back at the shadowy forms working in the night. The other dwarves continued unloading crates, oblivious to Myrddin and Curdon. When the Bronzebeard turned back, he whipped his right hand in Curdon's face, knocking the Wildhammer back.
Nay, lad. Just wanted to see for myself where the line between fact and fiction lay.
Myrddin was already on his way back to the carts by the time that the shock of the blow had worn off. Curdon simply stood at the gates, staring into the dark of the night. Myrddin smacked some sense into Curdon. All at once, he felt foolish for taking the scepter from the high seats. What did he intend to do with it? Leave the city and forsake his duties as a member of the council? Tarnishing not only his own honor, but that of Falstead and the rest of his clan as well? A moment later, one of his clan members showed up with some good news. One of the griffins had been able to save one of Skyri's eggs from the fire. Hesitantly, he placed his palm on the egg. It was somehow warm, but the sensation was altogether different than the stifling heat of Ironforge. The warmth coursed through Curdon's veins and made him feel as though he were standing under the blue skies of the hinterlands, bathed in the light of the sun. In that moment, everything became clear. He knew what he had to do, regardless of the consequences, to honor King Magni and fulfill his own duties as a member of the Council of Three Hammers. The brilliant plan that Curdon came up with was to show up at the ceremony of reforging, where Moira explained to the crowd that there was a thief who had stolen a piece of the artifacts. Curdon stepped up to the plate. He told all present that it was he that had taken it, and Myrddin asked if he had gone mad. He was going to start a riot. Curdon had not gone mad, though. He told them all that it was foolish to reforge this weapon as a symbol of the current union, to try to get back the Ironforge of their ancestors. This is a new Ironforge. It will never be the one of the past, and reforging Monomous Hammer surely will not change that. He slammed his artifact down, and with his mighty storm hammer, he shattered it. The heirloom exploded in a shower of iron shards. The dwarves in the crowd, they froze in sudden bewilderment. Confusion rippled across their faces. The new Ironforge begins here. Ask yourselves, do you want to start it by putting this hammer back together so that one day it can be broken again? The Wildhammers have chosen to take a step forward, not back. Who among you is with us? Myrddin was the first to join him as he smashed his own piece, and even Moira was forced to join them, shattering the lie and breaking the way for a new future for all clans. At the end of the story, Curtner decides that his place is not with the council. It truly never was. He apologized to Falstad for taking the position in the first place. Falstad had led their people for 20 years as Curtner spent this time in Outland. The dark portal reopened, Curtner showed up again from Outland, he brashly took over as if all those years of service meant nothing. Curtner passed on leadership to Falstad as he was supposed to, and he would now follow his own destiny as Falstad, he joined Moira and Muradin on the council. This change to the council and the shattering of the planned ritual was but one of the many obstacles that the three dwarven leaders faced, as Lorewalker Cho explained during Mist of Pandaria.
Once upon a time, moments ago in fact, a great king sought help from a trio of powerful dwarves, the Council of Three Hammers. The king's scouts had discovered that Zandalari trolls threatened the dwarven capital. Surely, the king thought, if he helped them with their troll problem, they would give him more troops for his campaign against the Horde. But what the king did not realize is that the dwarves did not trust one another. "We cannot help you," said the Bronzebeard dwarf, "for if we turn our back on the Dark Irons, they will defeat the Wildhammer and take over Ironforge." "We cannot help you," said the Wild Hammer Dwarf, "for if we turn our back on the Dark Irons, they will defeat the Bronzebeard and take over Ironforge." Oh, the king was furious. "If none of you help, then Ironforge will fall under siege." Only one dwarf offered to help the king. "We will lend you our strength," said Moira of the Dark Iron. "We will trust our dwarven brothers, and we will show them what loyalty means." And so, Moira and the High King set out into the snow to save the city, leaving the others to think about their actions. What happens next? I must know.
Muradin and Falstad, they still don't trust Moira and the Dark Iron Dwarves, but Moira is dedicated to proving the worth of not only herself, but also her clan. She wants to carve out a future for her people and her son that will one day rule her people, so she decides to show the right way and join Varian on his mission.
"It's heartening to see you here, Moira. You have my thanks."
"Indeed. With the aid of your champions, the Dark Irons will put an end to the Zandalari threat in Dunmarrow. We will prove our loyalty to the Council, Ironforge, and the Alliance here today, and with our own blood." "The storm has ended. Forward, Dark Irons! To battle we march!"
"Well fought. I see the Dark Irons are as formidable as ever."
"That they are, King Varian. And at the service of the Alliance, I might add."
"For that, I'm glad. The Bronzebeards and Wildhammers will regret not having been here to share in your glory."
"Better they're grateful for the clansmen spared death on this miserable hillock. We sought to protect and impress, not to shame."
"Well, you've done just that. Come, let us return to Ironforge and announce your victory to the Council."
The High King, his champions, and the Dark Iron Dwarves worked together to save Ironforge. The other dwarven leaders were ashamed of their behavior and vowed never again to allow fear or distrust to cloud their judgment. And so it was a human king who helped to unite the dwarven clans so long divided. Free to trust one another, all three dwarven leaders pledged their full strength to the Alliance cause.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is pretty much the end of Muradin's story. He does show up here and there, like he met with Lily Stormstout in the story Quest for Pandaria. He was present during Garrus' trial in Pandaria in the novel War Crimes. He shows up at the Alliance garrison to offer quests during Wars of Draenor. But the real story, the real events that he took place in, they end here. at least for the moment. Time will tell where Muradin's path may lead him. The council is coming closer together, but old hatreds die very hard, and some speculate that Magni Bronzebeard might return in the next expansion. If that is truly the case, what will happen between Moira and her father, between Muradin and his older brother? Only time will tell, but one thing's for certain, Muradin kicks some serious arse and has one hell of a story. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for watching, and a big thank you to Nixima Muklak for doing an amazing job with the dwarf voices. I could have never done it as well as they did. If you don't know who these guys are, then you're definitely missing out, so I've linked one video of Nixium and one video of Muklak on the screen. Under those videos, you can find the links to two videos that I've made connected to Muradin's storyline. On the left, we have the story of Falstead Wildhammer, while on the right, we have the story of Blackrock Mountain, which also talks about the history of the Dark Iron Dwarves and all that good stuff. Have a great week, everyone. Subscribe if you like my videos, and until next time, guys. See ya!